This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This is my first real solo show that I was hands-on with. I have another exhibit in Baltimore where it was more so filtered through the museum with it being an institution, but this is my first real show, so I'm like, I'm happy as hell. I want to thank every last one of you for coming and viewing my work. It really means a lot to me. Before I get started, I just want to shout out Michael Wood, Kwame Rose is running late. Megan, can you come up? This is my girl. Her picture's over here, too. She's an amazing activist from Baltimore. My girl Shannon came. Put your hand up, Shannon. She made it. That's my girl. She was on the front lines with me also. So we have a lot of people from Baltimore that have been putting in a lot of work. But basically, my name is Devin Allen. I'm born and raised in Baltimore. I spent a lot of time in West Baltimore growing up. I never thought I would ever be a photographer. Never even thought of that. Growing up, you know, my mom is right here. My mom is like my rock. That's my foundation. I have a very close-knit family. My family is from Park Heights, Emerson Village, Garrison. We are real heavy in the west side of Baltimore. So growing up, you know, life was, it was difficult, but I always had family to get me through it. And when I was bad. I'm about to lie to y'all. I had a very, very short temper. Most people in the city know my name. My nickname is Moody, because I'm bipolar. I go from 1 to 10, 10 to 1. I'm happy, I'm mad, I'm sad for no reason. I'm a Gemini, I can't explain it. So growing up, you know, I had a Napoleon complex because I was very small. I'm small. I'm still small. So I used to fight a lot, get suspended. My mother would be up to school every other day. They knew her. Oh, my God, Miss Allen is coming. You know, suspended from this school to that school, back and forth, you know. So growing up, I had a lot of close friends. I'm 27 now, but by the time I was 21, I buried like 5. And by the time I hit 27, I stopped counting. I think last time I counted, I was at like 20. You know, and my mother, she knows a lot of my friends that are dead and gone. You know, just talking about them, you know, I get, you know, teary eye, my voice break up. So, you know, I'm going to tell you that story. So I lost my first friend in high school. He was murdered over a dice game, over a couple dollars and Lord knows what. And got a T-shirt made. That was my first friend. And I thought that was it. You know, hit 21, I started getting to the streets. So my mother worked hard. So I always wanted to not worry her. So what I would do is me and my friends, we would get a little bit of weed together, we would sell our weed, and we would hustle, and we'd make money enough to buy Jordans and our clothes, so I wouldn't have to go to my mother and get on her nerves, because I was already spoiled enough. Because I grew up in the city and the county, so I was blessed more than others in Baltimore City. So by the time I was 21, you know, I had climbed the ladder. I had guys hustling for me. Me and my best friends were hustling for me. We was making a lot of money. We was having fun, partying all the time, and then I found I had a daughter on the way. And when I had my daughter, my father was never really in my life. He's around now, but he's like in and out. I really don't like him too much. He gets on my nerves. But I love him, but he never was around, you know. So when I had my daughter on the way, it was like, all right, I want to be a dynamic father, not just an amazing father, but a father that my daughter can basically say, that's my dad, you know, years later, that's my dad. She can go to school and brag, my father, the truth. You know, he do this, he do that. He's amazing. You know, he's out of this world. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I went to my mother and I said, all right, I need a job. Help me find a job or whatever. Like, I tried college. I tried all those different things. It didn't work for me. So I spent 3 years in corporate America working at Transamerica, processing premiums and credit. The money was cool, but I was miserable. I hated it. I was bored. The only thing good we had was free lunch, and they took that. So I actually, I had a friend. We went to high school together. He was like the real clean-cut guy. You know, we'd be outside, you know, getting in trouble and everything. He was like, I'm going to the Army. You know, so he went to the Army, went to Iraq, came back. He said, yo, let's do a poetry night. And I said, poetry in the hood? No, we're not coming to no poetry night in the hood. Nobody want to hear a poem. Let's do like a something, rappers or something. He's like, no, poetry is the wave, yo. Listen to me. I said, all right, cool, let's do it. So we did the poetry night. 3 people came. And I said, look, I told you. He's like, no, you got to give him time. Promoted on Twitter because I was a party promoter. I tried everything until I found photography. So he said, yo, just put it on Facebook, put it on Twitter. Instagram wasn't out yet. So I was like, all right, cool. So I start promoting. Next thing I know, 200 people on a Tuesday. And I was like, oh, yeah, we about to clean up. We about to make some money now. So that's all I was worried about. So we did a poetry night. It was very successful. And he came to me frustrated, like, yo, we making money. We splitting it 50-50, but you're not doing nothing. And I said, yes, I am. I'm promoting it. He's like, all you do is promote, and then you sit at the bar, and you flirt with every girl in here while I'm hosting and saying all the poems and booking all the poets. So I said, all right, cool. I'm going to write a poem then. So I wrote a poem, and I'm thinking it's easy. So when I got up there, I'm just up there stuttering, like, and forgot all the words. I pulled my iPhone out, try to find it. So after a while, I got good. But I was like, poetry's just not for me. You know, how can I be a poet without being a poet? You know, so I said, all right, well, I'm going to take pictures and put them on T-shirts. So I took pictures, you know, hand symbols, pictures of microphones, anything that symbolizes poetry, and I would put them on T-shirts and then sell them. So that was very successful. And then I found through photography, it was very stress relieving for me. You know, it was like I'm having an out-of-body experience. I'm not myself right now. I'm a different person when I get behind that lens. You know, people smile for me. It's a certain type of connection you get between your muse and yourself that I get when I'm capturing people, even if they know I'm not capturing them. So from there, I just dived into photography. And from that, I started to transform. I found my purpose. And from that, I couldn't hang in the streets no more. I didn't have time to hang with my friends. I didn't have time to sit on a corner. So a lot of my friends were mad. They didn't understand that I was becoming a man and that I was changing. So from there, you know, I would come, I would ride through and say, yo, what's up? You know, from there, I found myself, the way I dressed changed, the way I talked changed, and I felt comfortable in my own skin. And from there, they didn't understand it. They cracked on me. Well, you got on skinny jeans? Don't wear skinny jeans. Why you got them boots on? Why you got them Converses on? You tripping. But I was happy. You know, like, I can go down, go home, lay down. I had to worry about looking over my back. This person not liking me. I had to worry about being shot in the back or any of that. I was happy. You know, so me and my best friend, we had, like, a very bad argument. And we never reconciled that. And from there, I was in the house editing pictures. I'll never forget. And my best friend, he's like my brother. He walked to the door, and I got a phone call, and it said, Moody, Dade been shot in the back 7 times. And I'm like, what? Like, are you serious? Like, not, come on. So then next thing I know, I just see on Twitter, and everybody tweeting me like, Devin, Moody, are you okay? We heard what happened to Dade, you know, this whole bunch of, you know, like, at that point, I just was mad. So I broke down, and I just remember my daughter trying to pick me up, and my best friend came to the door, like, what's going on? I said, yo, they just killed Dade. And I was like, for real? You know, like, we just cried all night. And then from there, the next day, I was like, I'm going to go pay respects to his mother because we was real close. His mother was my mother, vice versa. And I went, and my other best friend, I had 3 best friends. The other one was dead. You know, he was totally distraught. You know, like, growing up, like, I don't lie about my past. I'm very open about it. I hung with some serious dudes. I hung with drug dealers. I hung with killers. One of my best friends was a bona fide killer, but we were friends. He didn't grow up. The streets turned him into that. And you know, he was a Muslim, and he started diving back into the Quran and really finding himself also, so he wasn't in the streets as much. But that drove him back into the streets, losing Dede. So he had the gun on, and I'm just hugging him, like, yo, please don't go out there. Like, just let's figure out what's going on, you know. Just chill out for me, you know. And he was drunk and distraught. He said, yeah, I'm a chill. I said, look, I got a photo shoot to do. I was like, come to the studio. We're going to smoke some hookah, we're going to have a drink, and we're going to celebrate this man's life, and then we're going to go in the house. He said, all right, I'm going to do it just for you because I love you. And I said, thank you. And I was like, call me when you're on your way. This is the address. So I leave, and then like an hour and a half later, I get a call. You know, Crispin shot, come to University of Maryland. So I'm thinking he's drunk, and he shot himself in the foot. You know, he was just that retarded. So, you know, me and my I pick up my other best friend, my third one. He's like my brother. We rush down there. So we laughing and giggling and everything. And then I remember him telling me the story where my first best friend got shot. He got shot 7 times. He died between his front door and his screen door. His sister found him. And he said, I remember walking down because they called me and told me. And I was up the street. I walked down, and all I saw was a caution tape. He's like, I cut a piece of the caution tape and tied it around my my belt and went to the hospital. And when I got there, I remember walking, and his family member was standing in the grieving room, and he told me he was gone, and he was like, I broke down. So when I went to the hospital, when I got there, I just remember another mutual friend's family member standing at the door and told me, you know, like, he's gone, you know. And come to find out, the same guy that killed my best friend Friday killed my other best friend Saturday. So I lost both my best friends in one weekend. And I would have been with both of them if I didn't have photo shoots and didn't have to edit pictures. So from there, I knew my purpose and I understood, like, I'm going to put my all into that. And then from that point forward, I maxed out every credit card that I had. You know, I called my grandmother, like, hey, can I use your Best Buy card? For what? I was like, don't worry about it. I'm about to charge this motherfucker up. And I didn't know how expensive cameras was. I went and bought me a 60D, a lens. Then I was good until she told me, hey, you know that bill due this month. But after that, I start, you know, I linked up with a couple of local artists. We tried to build like an art club. That didn't work. I just kept pushing. I would go to New York and give out free prints and just for free, just like, here. They're like, you giving out free art? I'm shooting for free. I'm not getting paid for this. This is just to get my work out there. So when the uprising took place, you know, I was kind of known in the city. I had about 10,000 followers on IG, about like 5,000 on Twitter. So I had tried multiple times. I have shot the Mike Brown protests, Palestine and Israel conflict protests in Baltimore. And I used to try to get into the paper, would never get a reply, never get a reply. And I would send it through mutual friends that work with the paper, still wouldn't get a reply. And I'm like, damn, do I suck that bad? I can't get a reply. So I was like, you know what? I could go shoot this uprising, because I knew it was going to be an uprising. You know, Kwame Rhodes just walked in, and we hang in this place called City of Gods, and I remember sitting, and I saw the visual that you saw right here. That visual came through my phone via text. And all of a sudden, they said the same thing. Oh, Lord. And just the mentality of my city, we so strong, we so proud that I knew it wasn't going to blow over. We not Ferguson. We wasn't going to wait until, you know, till we had the trials. No, we need to handle this now. That's the mentality of our people. So it took our young people to stand up. So before they even stood up, I knew someone was going to stand up. If it wasn't our youth, if it wasn't the, you know, our 21 and up, I knew someone was going to, you know, grab this and, you know, get it done. So from there, I documented everything for 3 weeks straight. I didn't miss a beat. I was at every protest. And mind you, I worked that night from 12 at night to 8 in the morning with people with autism, intellectual disabilities. So I would shoot all day and then go to work, and then come back out that next morning and come shoot. And like my Shannon can tell you, we was out there every cookout that the city had. It don't matter wherever I was there. I just documented the whole thing, and I made some amazing friends. And when I was just shooting, I just was shooting because that's where my heart is at. I love my city. That's where I was born and raised. And I'm shooting, and I'm posting pictures. I use a little Fuji camera with Wi-Fi, and what I would do is I would shoot. And then I was shooting black and white and then transfer it to my phone and post the raw image on Instagram and Twitter as I shot. So I would shoot, post. It's actually kind of stupid when you're in the middle of an uprising and police running around, but I wasn't thinking, I just was caught in the moment. And then from there, as I'm posting, you know, I remember when the first initial, we call it an uprising, an unrest, but you know, in an uprising, there's different stages. You have riots, you have your looting, you have your prayer, the healing process, all that in tune into one is the uprising. But the first initial riot started from racial slurs from baseball fans were calling us niggas, monkeys, and everything else. And that's what they called us. And that's what set the youth off. And that's when the fights broke out into the streets. And I remember documenting that and then posting that. And I'm out there shooting. I'm just like, I can't believe this. It felt like a movie. I can't believe this. And I'm shooting. My mother called my phone. So I'm camera one hand, phone another. And I said, hello. She's like, what you doing? I said, I'm down here shooting. She said, all right, well, your daughter getting on my nerves. Come get her. I said, all right, I'm on my way. So I keep shooting. She called back. And she said, where you at? You said you was on your way. It's getting crazy down there. Are you safe? I said, yeah, I'm shooting. I'm fine. You on your way? I said, yeah, I'm walking to the car right now. I'm saying all this, but the police on this side and the protesters on this side, and I'm right in the middle, like this, just shooting. And she said, boy, you lying. I see you on CNN. You need to come bring your ass home now. So, you know, I just kept documenting, and when I snapped the time cover, I didn't think nothing of it. You know, I'm literally, they would turn and defacing the police cars on one side, and I watched this young man run past me, and I was like, where he going? And that's when I saw the police forming behind us, and he threw something, and I just snapped. And then next thing I know, I just turned and ran, hopped the gate, ran through another gate and tried to get away. And then I posted it. I was like, this picture is dope. I posted it. I almost got trampled and everything. Posted it, kept posting. And then when I went home, I was like, dang, this picture got 1,000 retweets and this got this amount of likes. What's going on? And next thing I know, I had people like Lettuce, DJ Drama, Omar from The Wire talking about, this is what's going on in Baltimore. Follow this page. And I'm like, wow, this is crazy. Next thing I know, BBC UK tweets me, we want to talk to you now. I was like, oh, you kind of aggressive, but you lucky I like the BBC. You know, at work, we only had like three channels, and BBC was one of them, so I was always tuned in. So I called him. He's like, Devin Allen, you're amazing. What's going on the ground? So I'm like, this is going on the ground, and I'm just telling him. He's like, wow, that's crazy, crazy. Then he posted the interview, and I was like, he didn't cut nothing out. I was like, wow. And that's the guy I know, Fusion Magazine, said, Devin, you're amazing. What are you doing? Are you a photojournalist? I'm like, no. I'm a black boy with a camera, and that's what I am. That's exactly what I said to my, he direct message. I said, look, I'm a black boy from Baltimore with a camera. Right. And he said, well, I'm going to go fund you $300 just because I like your work. I don't want nothing. You know, he did want something. He actually sent a journalist down to hang with me later down the line. So I had to pay him back for that $300. But next thing I know, I get a blocked call and answer it. It's like an unknown number. You know, I don't know how y'all feel. I know when you call my phone from an unknown number, you either, you're a bill collector, you playing on my phone. I don't know who you are. So I answer, and he said, hey, is this Devin Allen? And I'm like, yes, who's this? He said, hey, this is Paul Mokey and Olivier from Time. Huh? He's like, yeah, this is Paul, we're from Time. We wanted to talk to you about what's going on in Baltimore. I was like, for real? You serious? He was like, yes, for real. And I got smart with him. And then he was like, no, we really want to know what's going on the ground. So we talked for like 2 hours just talking about what's going on in Baltimore. And he was like, your images are amazing, you know? And he hung up. He called back and said, we want to do a blog interview. So we did the blog interview. And that was amazing. That was dope. And he called me back and said, hey, Devin, send me these 8 images. So he sent them. He was like, these images are amazing. We want to publish them. I said, where? He said, on Time. I said, for real? He said, yeah, we're going to publish them. I said, I'm going to get paid. He was like, yeah, we got you. We're going to send them. We're going to send your W-2s over everything. And I was like, wow, I'm a journalist for today. And so he sent it over. And so I would be out shooting. Like I said, I was out for 3 weeks. And we kept in contact. He kept calling. What's going on? And he said, send me this image with the guy running from the police. I sent it to him. He said, this look amazing. I think I want to put this on the cover. He's like, but we already have a cover, so don't get your hopes up. So I said, all right, cool. I didn't think nothing of it. I was like, well, if I don't get it, at least I have a full spread. Like, a full spread in Time. Like, I've never been published before, so that's like top of the line for me. So next thing I know, he was supposed to call me. He never called. So I'm at work getting my guys ready for school and getting them dressed. So then I take a break, and I just sit on the sofa, and I hop on Twitter. I see all these notifications. I'm like, my page is booming right now. What's going on? So I'm just scrolling, and I get to the bottom, and it says, amateur photographer from West Baltimore snags the cover of Time. I just cried. Like, I just bust out tears. I called my mother, and I just had gotten into a real bad car accident. And I called my mother crying. And I just remember my mom saying, what you crying for, boy? I know you ain't just crashed that car you just bought. And I said, no, ma, I got the cover of Time. She started crying. She called my godmother. She crying. Called my uncle, the toughest guy in the world. He crying. So everybody just crying. So then I'm just like, it's just from there, just like interview after interview after interview. In the back of my mind is like, wow, like I'm on cloud 9 right now, but it's a lot more work to do. So from there, I continue to protest. I continue to do my work. But I was so inspired by the youth, how they was on the front lines. And like the front lines were serious. Like they done dropped tear gas on us, pepper sprayed. I got hit with shields. And the kids had no fear. And I just wondered if these kids, they have all this time in the world and they just riding bikes, don't have nothing to do. What if they had a camera though? I guarantee you these kids can outshoot me because their creativity level is so free. They're not worried about my ISO is too high, my shutter speed is too fast. They're not worried about that. They just want to get that shot. So from there, I started to go from me and I just said, well, I'm going to just start my own program. I didn't want to work with nonprofits because the thing is, I went to programs. I know how it is. You go Tuesday, you go Thursday. What about all that time in between? These kids in the city got a lot of time on their hands. I wanted to build a relationship where I'm making it. You know, you're watching me come from the bottom to the top. They can witness that. I'm your proof. Now follow me. And that's the goal. So I basically started my own little program teaching inner city kids in Baltimore City photography. It started off with a GoFundMe. And even the guy from GoFundMe said, I love it. Here's $1,000. You know, next thing I know, D-Ray, who's another amazing activist and a good friend, he called me, you know, we talked for an hour, you know, about nothing, just activism and he wanted to talk about politics. I don't get into politics, so I just was yawning. He said, oh, I forgot to call you. Russell Simmons for you. So I said, look, you sat on this phone for 1 hour talking about politics, and Russell Simmons is looking for me. He said, yeah, I don't know, but they looking for you. Here's his number. Call him. So I called him. I called Michael Skolnick, who was his political advisor, and he said, hey, David, we've been looking for you so bad. How's it going? What you doing? You want some money? We saw your program. We want to help you get it off the ground. So he said, I said, sure, that'd be awesome. And at that time, I raised like $3,000 from my supporters and my amazing Instagram family and Twitter family. Donated $3,000 in 2 weeks. It was amazing. And he was like, don't think about you too. Take care of yourself. You know, like me in the back of my mind as an activist, when you're an activist, you're very selfless. To be an activist, you can't be selfish. You have to be selfless because you're doing the work. You're the voice for the people. You're doing the work for the people. They can't really do the work. So I said, all right, I'm not going to think about myself. I said, I know this is much. And when I added it up, I was like, ooh, that's a little bit too much money. So I said, look, I need $20,000. He said, all right, we're going to send a check over. And I was like, for real? So they sent the check over. I got my camera. So now I teach NECD kids photography. I was picked up by Under Armour. So I went to Asia and spent a week in Asia photographing Steph Curry. They're big supporters of my work. They're making T-shirts for my kids and my youth program. I'm going to be working for them full-time so I can stay in Baltimore and continue my work. Samsung, another company, donated a lot of camera equipment to my kids, so they have Samsung cameras. Traded in some of my old stuff, bought more cameras, so I'm going to be working in all city schools now, teaching inner city kids photography. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm just trying to give back and keep the conversation going, and I'm just going to end this off with this exhibit, explaining a little bit about the exhibit. The front room is basically the real Baltimore. That's the Baltimore that Freddie Gray grew up in. When you see those vacant homes, you see them projects, you see them kids outside, that's Freddie Gray's home. That's what he saw from his own two eyes every day. And then when you walk through the room, I did this collage randomly. It had no type of mock-ups or anything. We just threw the pictures up there because that's what the uprising was. It was a beautiful, chaotic moment in Baltimore and the world's history where activists were born. And then right across are beautiful people that do work in the community. There's so many more. I couldn't fit everybody, but those are some of my favorite pictures of some of the people that are at least trying or are doing positive work. We have D-Ray, we have Confidel, we have Shadow, Kwame Rose, we have D. Watkins, who's an amazing author. We have Michael Wood, who was a police officer in Freddie Gray's neighborhood for 10 years, and now he's on this side of the fence. We have Malika Reed, who leads all the women, and only woman to bring both the mayors together, past and present. We have so many amazing people on that wall. I'm just an outlet for them. I just give them the platform, and I just document as I go along. So that's my story. Next, I want to call my Be More family up. Meg, Kwame, Michael Wood, come on up. These are people who I've been on the front lines with in multiple ways, from social media to being on the ground or to almost getting locked up or trying to stop him from getting locked up. But this is my family. This is just a part of my family. We got Sharina. We got Gloss Ray somewhere in here. She makes the amazing T-shirts that has all the names of people who have fallen due to police injustice. So you want to check out her stuff. So I'm going to let them tell their story. But first, I want Kwame to go because me and him, we bumped into each other way before the uprising in the city, just hanging out, partying. So he's what you sitting down for? Go ahead. Kwame Rose.
Yeah. Well, I think before I tell my story, like I just want to say, Devin is like out of the last, I don't know how long it's been. It feels like it's been life now, but ever since the incidents that happened back in April, when I mean like wholeheartedly, Devin has been like the most influential person in my life. Like, I'm so proud. I've been in three different cities today just to make it here. Like, I booked a plane ticket like an hour before the plane took off just to be here because I couldn't miss this event for him. Like, so just give it up for Devin one more time. For those that don't know me, my name is Kwame Rose. I'm from West Baltimore, but I kind of grew up on a different side. I always say I grew up on a different side of West Baltimore than Freddie Gray. But a lot of people know me as the guy that confronted Geraldo Rivera in the middle of Penn North the day after what became known as the Baltimore Uprising. And what's actually even more funny is that Devin and I had crossed paths so many times before we even gained this type of bond. Like, we hung out in the same hood with Freddie Gray, childhood friends at City of God's. There's this block, Highland Street Market. Baltimore is known for, like, their street markets. So there's this one market, Highland Street, and it's, like, show you kind of how, like, close Baltimore is and gentrified it is. So on one block, you got the liquor store, the trap house, and on the next block, you got the coffee shop, and all the hipster white people live there. But in the middle of it, you got this one block. It's a barbershop. It's a clothing store. It's a Tex-Mex restaurant. It's a hair salon. And then it's a African shop at the end where, like, everybody from Baltimore go. Like, all the men from Baltimore just go get their hair cut, just have a good time. So we bumped paths going through there, like, getting our hair, waiting all day to get our hair cut by Lemon and then getting messed up. And then but... So we had bumped into there. So the day after the Geraldo video, like subsequently, Devin captured like kind of like a more important moment. So Geraldo had went on TV, called me some names, and I didn't really like it. I was still amped up. So I went and approached him, and I was like, turn the camera off and like, let's talk as men. But Geraldo made it a bigger deal, and he tried to turn it into a fight. He actually swung at me that night. But what people don't realize is that we were standing on Penn North. We were standing on people like their work, where they work at, where they like, stay on the block so they can make their money. So that night, Devin captured the picture of me and Geraldo, but he also was there to witness, like, I got chased out of Penn North by the hood niggas, like, because they was trying to make money and they felt like we was causing a bigger disruption. You know, they didn't really understand it because it was all the beginning. We all didn't understand it. So before the Freddie Gray situation happened, I was just working at a hotel. I dropped out of college. I'm only 21. I dropped out of college. I had came home, started a mentoring group in one of the worst performing middle schools in Baltimore City with three of my childhood friends. We tried to teach the young men. We took the worst 25 performing young men, transformed them to the top 25 performing students in the class, took them to the White House, taught them how to tie a tie and things of that nature. Just basically tried to give them that male leadership that so many kids in Baltimore City are missing. Like I said, I grew up different than Freddie Gray and then a lot of my friends that I know. I kind of grew up like very privileged in Baltimore, which is like kind of like ironic. Both of my parents are married to this day. They're successful business owners. I grew up in Jack and Jill of America, if it's any other bougie people in here with me. But I always, for my realization is that my privilege, my limited amount of privilege, that financial privilege, it never set me free from like what happens in society. So the first time I ever got called a nigger was in private school in eighth grade at the same school Babe Ruth went to, Cardinal Gibbons. And that moment for me kind of let it be known, like, you know, I'm not free. And I blame my parents for a long time. Like, why didn't y'all tell me like I was a nigger? Why I grew up thinking I was better than everybody else. So I went to public school from then on out. I wound up getting a full scholarship on a debate team to the University of Texas where I wouldn't debate. I don't know if anybody knows about debate, but like normally it's like United States federal government should. No, I always had a love for music and rapping and telling a story. I used to like Kanye West, but that was like pre-graduation. And but... So what I did, what me and my partner would do and what kind of gained us notoriety is that we would actually rap the entire time. So we wouldn't read no evidence. We would read these couple Malcolm X clips, play a Lauryn Hill song, but we would rap our personal experiences in that debate space and kind of claim that and say, this is the importance of us taking control of our narrative. And this gives us more education as humans and it has a more of a spillover effect. And I think that's what's kind of important about the space that we're in now. After Baltimore, like, you know, we Black Lives Matter had been around before Baltimore, but a lot of people in Baltimore weren't really that active, myself included. I always say I was active way before I was called an activist, and that's true because I didn't realize what we were doing. So now I know through the power of social media how an image can go, how a video can go viral, how like a former cop can tell his story. And we control, we take hold of that space and tell our stories, and it becomes so much more important. It becomes so much more like normal, like, I've been able, because of but taking control of the story, telling the things, I've been able to meet people like Devin, like Mike. Like, this is my family. Like, I don't, you know, when I go to jail, Michael will bring the bail money. Megan will be right there. Every video, Megan's yelling, he didn't do anything. Like, but it's just like, this is the type of space, and I think, is it Slot? I thank y'all for like having this type of space, because it's not that many spaces like this. 8 months ago, we would have just, like, when this all this started, we do the same thing every week that we did before. We would have just been at City of God's drinking Peach Paul, like, at the barbershop just talking. But the death of Freddie Gray gave hundreds of thousands of people in Baltimore City a new purpose for life. And that's something that, like, we'll have to live with for the rest of our lives, because we can't go back. I can't. I got a criminal record now. So, but thank y'all for coming out. And I'm really, like, Moody, I'm so proud of you. Like, I thank y'all. So...
Now I'm gonna call up Michael Wood. This is my brother, like my real brother. I know the complexion is kind of different, but this is my brother. You know, he's yeah, he's a little lighter. He light skinned. He a red bone. But you know, this is my brother. You know, he's a rare breed. You know, probably one in a million. You know, a police officer that was once on the opposite side of the fence who. Basically, he spent 10 years, 11, you old, but he spent 11, he spent half my life in West Baltimore and, you know, Freddie Gray's neighborhood, you know, the Penn North area, Sandtown and everything else. And for him, you know, he had an honorable discharge, but to realize, you know, the wrongs of Baltimore City and just to even be standing up here with me, you know, I'm on the opposite side of the fence. To support us, to be the voice, to explain, to give us answers that police officers don't give us. You know, so you're about to hear from a real police officer, not like these other, you know, wasn't in the mud. Like, he was in the hood. He was in the bottom, you know. He was in places I wouldn't go if I ain't had no camera. Oh, I had one of my friends that lived around there. But, you know, Michael Wood, everybody.
Thanks, guys. I want to move this up a little quicker so we have time so everybody can ask questions, especially of Devin. But to give you my story real quick, in 2003, I joined the Baltimore Police Department, and I did it because I wanted to run the streets. I wanted to have the adrenaline thrill. I wanted to do car chases. I wanted to chase drug dealers and get guns off the street, because that's what good guys do, right? So I did my way through, saw the transgressions that people hear about, but I still felt like I was doing the right thing until I got into drug work. And I got into a major case squad where I was the youngest detective there. And I spent days on end from sun up to sundown sitting in vacant buildings, sitting in cars, and watching the neighborhood as it went throughout its day. What that enabled me to do was see the evils of the drug war. And as I sat there all that time, what I saw, was I didn't see people like Devin through the eyes of the police car, through that little fishbowl. I saw them before the dealing started. I saw them as they woke up. I saw them as their parents went to school, as the kids went to school. I saw them getting the little brothers onto the school bus. I smelled food cooking, and I heard the language. I heard everybody talking about what the police were doing. And then I started to see that Devin and everybody else in those neighborhoods, they were no different than me. They were everyone trying to struggle to survive in a system that prevented it. And I started to realize that I was part of that problem. I was the one that was there arresting everybody for offenses that were victimless crimes. Like, the idea of a drug pusher, like, you know, drug pushers don't exist. Drugs sell themselves. So they're not out there doing anything to anybody. They're standing there on the corner. And then when we go and we focus in those neighborhoods, and, you know, there's no white neighborhood where I'm standing in a vacant building looking and watching everybody from sun up to sun down to see every single transgression. And what I did was, because of the way the system works, you know, things like three strikes, you're out, and stuff like that. So I was a smart cop. I'm not going to lie about it. I knew what I was doing. So I would write warrants for days and then let them compound. So you see, I see you dealing for a day, and then I go home and I write a warrant. Case one. I don't say shit. I go back the next day. I watch you deal all day. Case two, I get a warrant. Do it the next day. Case three, we get to court. Warrant one comes up, guilty. Warrant two comes up, guilty. Warrant three comes up, guilty. That's three separate offenses for what I watched as one really continuous cycle. So you take that system and you manipulate it to make it as bad as possible. Luckily, I got out of drug work and I got promoted. And I had those seeds sowed. So I got into a supervisory position where I was out trying to supervise other officers, and now I was responsible for them. Then I got to see a different side, which was cops don't know shit. They don't know what an arrest means. They don't know the legality. I was in this small little world of drug work where I was isolated, and I didn't see the police department as a whole. Started to see the police department as a whole, started to see old men getting locked up because they were drinking a beer on their porch, and kind of just got sick of it and had that seed sowed. Then I got a job in headquarters after I got injured. And in headquarters, I begin to see the inside of the police department, what happens on the inside. Inside, black officers get punished more harshly. Black officers aren't included in the promotional process. Every step of the way, black officers never seem to find themselves in units like K-9. You'll see a bunch of white guys with dogs in the hood when there's plenty of black officers to go around, but you don't get those assignments that everybody wanted. So I started to try and fight that from the inside. This was in like 2009. So I went through this long effort to level the playing field for the good old boy network and promotional systems. And I laid out for 2 years of work everything you had to do to be a proper supervisor in the police department. The first group of people that I taught, 25 of them out of 50 were promoted to sergeant, and most of those were minorities. Well, that started the end of my downfall in the police department because I was stepping on the toes of everybody else's system. Eventually, I got out, and I kind of stuck that with me. I saw how bad it was, but I started to get my master's degree in management, and I wanted to focus on getting policing the way it should be, like properly managed, because you could see that in a system where your answer to everything is arrest, well, you're just sending people through this cycle of the criminal justice system. And I wanted to change that. I wanted to incentivize officers to help people instead of incentivize them to send people in jail, because the incentive is you get judged by arrest, so whoever gets the most arrests gets all the props, and they get the promotions, they get the deals, and then if a cop actually takes the time to try and form a relationship, that cop is actually not considered a good officer within the agency because they're not getting those stats that everybody wants. So I'm trying to figure out how to fix that, and I see Tamir Rice get murdered. And I can't think of an explanation for this. And I see policing stand around and say, this isn't murder. This is fear. So a 12-year-old boy is in a playground, the place he should be safest in all of the world, playing with the guns that the Christmas story tells you can go play with. But because he was a black boy standing there, he was gunned down in cold-blooded murder, and the entire system said, nothing's wrong here. But I said, that's Cleveland. I come from a black city with a black police commissioner, with a black city council, with a black mayor, with a black state's attorney, with a black attorney general, with a black president. It's not going to happen in Baltimore. And then Freddie Gray is murdered. And I see my very own union stand up and say we did nothing wrong. You take a man off the street and you put him in a metal box and you tell me that nothing's wrong when he comes out dead, and you got a problem. So I decided that was it. The blue wall was coming down. And I sat there and I went on Twitter after we were just, my beautiful wife and daughter here, we were just doing yard work. And I threw out 10 tweets of corrupt shit that I saw and participated in, to an effect. Came back about an hour later, and you know, we had like 1,000 emails, and Twitter was blowing up. So I got the attention, and I got the sensationalism that everybody wants to promote. Oh, here we tell the bad stories that the cops did. But that was okay, because we used that, and we used that to build a platform so that every time I get attention, I bring Shan up, I bring Devin up, I bring Kwame with me every time we can, and we share this platform, and we formulated these relationships that are just unbelievable through social media and through the uprising. I would never know Devin, and I would never know Kwame, but they're right. I mean, these guys are my brothers, and we're going to keep doing this fight and moving along. But I want you to also keep in your mind real quick that don't paint me as a hero. You know, I only understand the other side. I understand what hell's like because I was lording over it. So keep in mind that I'm not a hero. It's about putting the stage for these guys. And if you got to sensationalize me to give them a platform, then please do so.
Next, I'm going to have my sister come up. She's like the quietest activist in Baltimore City. She never really says too much, but she's always on the front lines. So, Megan, you want to say like a few words?
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Megan Kenny. First of all, I'm really humbled to be a part of this exhibit and that Devin asked me to share. It's really humbling. Really quickly, I don't want to take a lot of time. One of the reasons I got started frontlining and being in the streets is 2 days after Freddie had died. Actually, a day after Freddie had died, a friend of mine posted on Facebook basically asking, the community was in the streets and had marched to the district, and she had asked, where are all the white people? And I sat there and said, where am I? You're right, I'm just sitting here. So the next day I went out and I looked around and I could count. There was hundreds of people in the street, hundreds. And I counted on one hand how many other white people there were. And I realized that we sit in our privilege and we swim in it and we don't even know it. And murders can happen. Black people are being killed simply because the color of their skin. And that does not happen to us. And that's unacceptable. And so I go out in the streets to be a white face in solidarity. I go out in the streets to amplify the voices of the oppressed. I go out into the streets to promote the counter narrative because the mainstream media does not give the true story. So I document, I post, I spread the counter narrative. And, you know, we have nothing to lose. We really don't. At the end of the day, I will always be white. I will always be Ivy League educated. I will always have a Johns Hopkins master's. Always. That will never be taken away from me. I have nothing to lose. People are dying in the streets, dying every day. And that doesn't happen to us, and it's not okay. And so we need to dismantle all of that shit that we have been indoctrinated into and in this privilege and in this system that's perpetuated and built on white supremacy. It has to be dismantled. It doesn't work. It doesn't make any logical sense. It's wrong. It's dangerous. It's violent. And it's killing people. So it is our responsibility for people in positions of privilege and power to help break it down, so that everybody can live in harmony and people aren't murdered for who they are.
All right, hey everybody. So I'm Megan from Philly. I was one of the outside agitators in Baltimore. That was a phrase that we heard a lot. And when I first heard the phrase, I was like, yo, is this like the civil rights movement? Are we in Alabama with Bull Connor and fire hoses? Like, are we hearing members of the White Citizens Council talking about people coming down south? Like, what's going on? But my comrades and I have been doing a great deal of organizing in Philly. We started a lot of our work around the murder of Brandon Tate Brown. How many people have heard about Brandon Tate Brown? So Brandon Tate Brown was murdered December 15th, 2014 in the Frankfort section of Philadelphia. The police lied and said that he had a gun, and that's why he was shot in the head. His mother, Tanya Brown, found out that he was murdered, not by the cops, not by the media even. I'm sorry, she did find out by the media because she watched it on TV. No one called and told her that her son was dead. And the only reason why she knew that was because she recognized the car that he was driving on the TV in the news. And so we created a campaign surrounding, you know, Brandon Tate Brown's death because it was something that was just so violent, something that was so wrong, and something that was just basically criminal. And so one of the major problems that we have in Philadelphia is that the police think that they can shoot people, but they don't have to give us any information. They don't have to tell us which cops did it. And so one of the first parts of our campaign was simply finding out who killed him. And it took us over a year to kill him. And we had many arrests. Many people were locked down. You know, I had comrades who are still being harassed as a result. How many people heard about the Lawncrest event up in the Northeast? Okay, cool. So, you know, as we went along with the Brandon Tate Brown campaign, you know, unfortunately, the same day that we decided to do an action around his murder, we also found out that Seth Williams, one of our black gatekeepers here in Philadelphia, had made a decision not to indict the cops despite the evidence that they had actually killed Brandon Tate Brown. And so there was a huge dog and pony show for the city councilmen up in the Northeast, where they pretty much were going there to talk about the community, but they were not going to mention the fact that Brandon Tate Brown had actually been killed in that same community, that they wanted to talk about cleaning gutters, you know, picking up trash and that sort of thing. So we went to Lawncrest and actually confronted Charles Ramsey, we confronted Seth Williams and other people on the panel. And unfortunately, the cops think that they can put their hands on you when you're protesting, but it was one moment of really great resistance that you should definitely check out and find out more about, where the people stood up and said, no, you're not going to put your hands on us, and you're going to tell us who killed Brandon Tate Brown. And fortunately, we were able to find out those names. If you did not know, the two officers who killed Brandon Tate Brown were Nicholas Corelli and also Hang Dang, so we have those names. And we were also able to fight and have the tape released of the actual murder. So just like Laquan in Chicago, there was a tape of Brandon Tate Brown being shot down that Charles Ramsey tried to hide. And if you don't know about our former commissioner, he was also extremely oppressive when he was the police commissioner in D.C. And D.C. is still paying people who were brutalized by him and his administration while he was there. So on to Baltimore. So after the whole Brandon Tate Brown organizing that we did in Philly, my comrades and I, we got a call that things were starting to pop off in Baltimore. So we went down on April 25th. We drove down from Philly, I think, about 8 in the morning, and so we got there around 9:30, 10 o'clock. We pull up to the City Hall area where they started out with the protest, and we saw people there. We were like, what's going on? You know, what's happening? People marched to the police station, and then people marched back into the neighborhoods, and we could see areas that look just like Philadelphia. When I look at Baltimore, I see North Philly, I see South Philly with the same row homes and the same appearances that we have here. And so one of the funniest conversations that I had when I was in Baltimore was right before things started to pick up in terms of the protests and the resistance that night. And this brother was there, and we were talking to him, and you know, when people started to get hype, started to, you know, want to resist the police, and someone said, no, no, stop, 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 because you always have people at protests who want to try to stop things and want to try to keep the status quo. And so this brother said, you need to stop telling us to stop. What happened in the morning was the morning. This is the night shift. And so that was the funniest things that took place while we were in Baltimore. But we got to the stadium, that area. We met Freddie Gray's brother, who was really helpful in speeding the protest along. But one thing that struck me about the area around the stadium was, despite the fact that there's tear gas there, despite the fact that things are being thrown, despite the fact that people are being brutalized, the police, you have all of these restaurants that are quite nice around the stadium, and you see white people in there eating as if nothing is happening. We went into these spaces and we said, why are you sitting here? What makes you think that you can stay here while this is happening, while people are being brutalized? And their answer was, this has nothing to do with us. So, you know, as somebody who, again, is an outside agitator, I'm like, yo, damn, that's the same thing that we hear in Philly. It has nothing to do with us. But again, it does. So my sister, who's also my comrade, as well as another young brother comrade, Key, they were both arrested right there in Baltimore. We actually say that they were kidnapped, because that's exactly what happened. They dragged my sister off the street, dragged my other comrade off the street as well, and they were arrested and taken down to the city jail. You know, I really want to give a shout out to some of our Baltimore comrades from Sharon Black and the People's Power Assembly. They really showed up for us, gave us a place to stay, and really supported us. But despite the fact that they were arrested, the most interesting thing actually isn't their arrest. It was the constant trips that we had to take to the courts between when they were arrested in April to when Key was finally found not guilty back in September, I believe. So we went back and forth to Baltimore from Philly for about 6 months. And so not only were we able to watch Morgan, my sister's trial, and Key's trial, but we were able to watch other people who had been involved in the uprising. And quite frankly, I have never seen such obvious bias. I have never seen such disdain from law enforcement, from judges, from the public defenders who were actually there to help the people who were arrested in my life. They quite clearly talked about the rebellion as a riot. And when people talked on the stand about it not being an actual riot, but it being rebellion, they were chastised and things like that. And you also even saw people who had hired lawyers, and the things that they were saying about their clients was quite interesting. We had people talking about, you know, how he was just down there to sell selfie sticks. He wasn't really down there to protest, as if protesting is something that is wrong. And so I think that we are dealing with serious First Amendment issues around protesting, and we're dealing with serious issues around the oppression of activists. And so my sister was acquitted back in July. She had a judge who was, quite frankly, very rude and very oppressive towards all of us on the bench. He called me a liar and said that I definitely did hear the helicopters that were going around, despite the fact that the helicopters never showed up by the time we were there. Obviously, there were many cops on the stand who lied. And, you know, fortunately, that is, she was found not guilty by a judge. Our comrade Key's case was even more difficult because he had an additional charge, outside of disorderly conduct. His charge was interfering with a lawful arrest. And so they tried to prove basically that he had de-arrested my sister. They weren't able to prove that, and he was found not guilty by a jury trial in Baltimore, which was an amazing thing. But again, the one thing that the prosecutor kept saying on the stand was, "You came all the way from Philly?" I'm like, damn, like, how far is Philly from Baltimore, really? Like, I didn't realize it was that far. I didn't realize that Baltimore was a sovereign nation that no one else was allowed to go to. And so, you know, what I really wanted to talk about today is a lot, but I don't have that much time. But what I really want to just, you know, leave you guys with is, it's just so important that we build the solidarity. You know, Philly is Baltimore. Baltimore is Philly, Philly is Ferguson, and we need to start creating these networks where we can support each other and help each other. Like, I love my city. People have called me a Philadelphia nationalist. I'm like, Philly? But, you know, this movement is bigger than just what is happening in our own city. It's even bigger than what's happening in the United States. You see people, you know, fighting oppression, resisting oppressive governments all over the globe. You see people dealing with gentrification in Israel, Baltimore, everywhere. And so I think that, once again, we need to make sure that we have that level of solidarity and that we're not closing ourselves off simply because we're from Philly or simply because we're from Baltimore. So, yeah, this is just my thoughts as an outside agitator, and thank you so much.